Welcome to the Hardwood Handicappers Podcast.
They're a bunch of guys who ain't never played the game, and they never got the girls in high school, and they just want to get in the game.
With your host, Jonathan Von Tobel.
See, the thing is, you guys look at me, you see the backwards hat, the gray socks, the funky outfit, and you say, now this guy's a chump, am I right?
No, f***ing geek. I'm a f***ing geek.
Only on the VSiN Podcast Network.
What's up and welcome in another edition of Hardwood Handicappers. I am your humble guide, Jonathan Von Tobel, flying solo today, but a lot of great content for you as we head into the second half of the NBA season. And that'll be a big brunt of what we're previewing here on episode 3. We're going to have your three hardest schedules in the second half, three easiest schedules in the second half, teams to fade, to follow, and as we are about 2 weeks away from the trade deadline, depending on when you listen to this, we'll dive into some of the reports as well that are out there. But there's a lot of names that are tied to certain teams, some that make sense to me, some that don't. We'll also analyze those, of course, from a futures perspective. Maybe certain teams, if they acquire that piece, could potentially get pushed forward. And I know a lot of people would initially think, like, well, what does the trade deadline do? We've seen a lot of trade deadline deals really help teams in the long run when it comes to pushing themselves toward an NBA championship. I mean, one of the more recent ones was Philadelphia's acquisition of Jimmy Butler, who, of course, was what, four or five, six bounces away from moving on potentially to the Eastern Conference Finals the year that Toronto ended up winning the whole thing. So these trades can move the needle, and these trades can make differences. You know, as we say all the time, you win in the margins, right, especially when it comes to front office work. And there are some names that I think can help out some certain teams. But there is one really actual heavily rumored deal that is out there that actually is centering around Jacob Roach, our producer's favorite team, the Boston Celtics. We'll get to that name and what that could potentially mean for that team. That'll be coming up a little bit later in the podcast, though. We also have, of course, some news and notes to get to as we, of course, now start the second half of play, and that's where I kind of wanted to start. We'll call them our hardwood headlines. I felt like it would be a clever name for that. But I wanted to get to the Brooklyn Nets first off because we did get some news over the last 12 hours. Kevin Durant is about to get more imaging on his hamstring next week. Let's hear from one Steve Nash, who talked about this in his availability earlier today, today being Thursday, and talked a little bit about, hey, not only just the severity of the injury, but what they're expecting, what the Brooklyn Nets are going to be doing with Kevin Durant as they move forward.
Kevin is getting better all the time, has a scan next week, and we'll assess him then. But he hasn't played in a month, basically, so you know, no matter what the scan says, there'll still be an appropriate ramp up and just try to make sure that we put him in a position to finish the season strong.
So all the coach speak that you really necessarily expect, right, from a coach who is discussing the status of a star player and his health. We haven't seen Kevin Durant, obviously, for a very long time. Just one of their last 11 games he's been on the floor. And, of course, they have won 10 out of those 11 games, thanks to my guy, James Harden. We'll get to that. Not a lot, though, today. Not a lot. But we'll get to that and the aspects of that going forward. Also, according to Nash, Durant is able to do half-court work and shooting drills. He's playing. He's not playing, excuse me, anything in terms of 5-on-5 or full-court high-speed running. And think about Brooklyn's next week of play, right? We're talking about tonight. Again, it's Thursday. So tonight against Boston. But then it really lightens up. Home games against Detroit and New York. You hit the road to take on Indiana and Orlando. And then coming up on March 23rd and 24th, you have road games in Portland and Utah. They're back-to-backs. So maybe you expect him to come back by then, but it definitely looks like if you just look at their schedule, they have some breathing room here to take their time with Durant and bringing him back. And Durant, too, by the way, is not the only one that we're waiting for, right? Blake Griffin's not going to play tonight against the Boston Celtics. He hasn't played since February 2nd. Nash talked about that as well, the status of Griffin and what they're going to be doing with him forward.
Well, that comes down to, you know, assessing him and having a plan in the coming days to give him the best opportunity to finish the season strong as well. He hasn't played in a while either. So although he's been working out individually, I think, you know, we want to be cautious and make sure that our plan is comprehensive for him to succeed as well. So, a similar answer to Kevin, but, we just want to make sure we take a good hard look and come up with a plan that, you know, everyone agrees upon and gives him a great chance to have an impact.
Yeah, similar to Kevin Durant, not surprising, again, with these kind of deals. And Griffin is more of a get him acclimated, get him ready to go because he hasn't played well, get his body ready, as opposed to a serious injury with Kevin Durant, which actually Nash alluded to in this press conference that we're listening to right now, that when they initially saw the injury and they did expect this long of a timeline because it was asked of him, hey, did you really expect him to be out this long when he was initially injured? And Nash alluded to the fact that the first imaging, of course, was a little bit of blood and that they couldn't really see it clearly. But as the pictures came clear and as they took more imaging later on, once it healed up a little bit, this is kind of what they expected. But as we move forward with this, and as we look at this, here's one more from Nash, because I think there is some worry, right, as to the longevity of these injuries, especially when it comes to Durant. Soft tissue injuries are always probably something to worry about. Nash, though, did allude to the fact, not really too worrisome.
Well, you know, we're at the mercy of how this all plays out. You know, the more games, the better. But we do have 35 games left, and you know, right now, I don't see anyone having an injury that'll hold them out for the majority of those games. It's just we'll monitor Kevin and Blake, and hopefully, we'll have good health and luck in the run in. But you know what it's like, you.
You know what it's like. Yes, we all know what it's like to run an NBA franchise, Steve. Yes, we do. But I do think now this opens the door for a bigger conversation, right? And I've been asked this a lot since the Blake Griffin acquisition. You know, what does Griffin mean for the Brooklyn Nets? What does he bring to the table? And so when they're fully healthy, the question of what does this team look like, and especially when it comes to the newcomer, Blake Griffin, right? Because I think we know what Kevin Durant's role is going to look like. He's a phenomenal off-the-ball player, very underrated defender, one of the best scorers in the NBA. But I'm really curious as to the role of one Blake Griffin and what he's going to do, right? Because we hear a lot of, well, he could play the small ball five. But if you've listened to this podcast, if you've read any of my work, if you followed this right over at VSiN in terms of my NBA coverage, you know, you'll remember that I love Jeff Green, at least in terms of what his role has been this year for the Brooklyn Nets and some of the numbers, right? Jeff Green at center this year, just center. Any of the lineups, as long as Jeff Green's playing center, Nets plus 8.1 per 100 possessions. But plug him in to their starting lineup in favor of DeAndre Jordan, right? So we're talking about James Harden, Kyrie Irving, Joe Harris, Kevin Durant, and then Jeff Green at center. We're talking about a net rating of plus 26.7 per 100 possessions with an offensive rating of 136.4. He's been incredible as their small ball five. And here's the thing, and this is going to blow the minds of a lot of people. Green is a slightly versatile defender. That's not what's going to blow your mind. What's going to blow your mind? That starting lineup that I rattled off there again, Harden, Irving, Harris, Durant, Green. Defensive rating of 109.7. That's really solid for this team. It's part of the reason why, yes, that is a historic offensive rating of 136.4, but you're giving up under 110 points per 100 possessions, right? If you have a historic offense and you're giving up that little defensively, and again, you know, that would still put you around average in terms of defensive rating on the year, right? 15th-ish. But for this team and the level of offense that they can play, it's absolutely astounding. And we've talked about this before on this podcast, right? Part of the numbers that you're starting to see, because the Nets are getting better defensively, even so slightly. On the season, defensive rating of just over 113.5, but over this 11-game stretch, we're talking about a defensive rating of about 112.4. It's because they have implemented that switching style that they had in Houston. Remember, where you just switch everything, and it really helps Harden as a defender as well. But again, I've always talked about this, just be below average. 109.7 is incredible. But then you get to the specifics of, again, the role of Griffin, right? Because we're talking about this because Griffin could potentially take minutes as a small ball five, but Griffin really hasn't been the same offensive player in a really long time, right? Both Jeff Green and Blake Griffin, career 33% shooters. Green's actually in the midst right now of a 42% shooting season. Griffin, if you look at it, finished in the 28th percentile or lower at his position in points per shot attempt three out of the last four seasons. His shooting at the rim the last two seasons, 55% and 65% this year, subpar, and his mid-range jumper has been below 40% on each of the last 4 years. And so to me, as Blake Griffin comes in here, I really hope that Brooklyn doesn't try to eat up the minutes of Jeff Green with Blake Griffin, because I think Jeff Green is a really solid small ball five. I think he fits that role extremely well for the Brooklyn Nets. The numbers obviously dictate that. And when you bring in a guy like Griffin, my hope, and what I think he is going to be, is a bench guy who could potentially fill out some small ball bench lineups as well, right? that provides some depth. But I really hope, because some of the numbers we have seen here when it comes to the small ball lineup of the Brooklyn Nets, I really hope that they don't try to force Blake Griffin into that role as their primary small ball five, because I think Jeff Green has done a phenomenal job. And I think that, of course, is why he's the better option, at least when it comes to their primary small ball center. Blake Griffin's going to help him. Blake Griffin's a bench scoring option. If Blake Griffin's coming off your bench and he's like your sixth, seventh, eighth guy off the bench, you're in a pretty good position. But I just really hope they don't make the mistake of trying to make him their primary small ball center, because I think the numbers really dictate that Jeff Green has done a tremendous job with that role. And by the way, too, as we talk about all this and we still wait, again, next week, it sounds like Kevin Durant will get imaging to see. And again, that's just more imaging next week. So it doesn't look like we're going to see Kevin Durant for a good chunk of time here. Helps my boy Harden, right? Helps my boy Harden just a little bit in terms of the race for MVP and what it's going to mean, because he's going to have more of a load on his shoulders. Kyrie Irving still is expected, I think at least, to miss some of these back-to-back situations to take away some of the stress from the shoulders. But the path is there for Harden. But I wrote about it over the weekend when it comes to the case for MVP, cases for, cases against. Wrote about all seven guys in the pecking order of the odds. Left out Donovan Mitchell, sorry. You know, it seems the mountain is a little too high for Donovan, but crazier things have happened. Remember Harden, I actually wrote about this in the piece too, minus 500 a couple years ago. It was the year Giannis won his first one. He was minus 500 to win the MVP that year. And then, of course, Giannis Antetokounmpo ended up winning it. But regardless, as Kevin Durant continues to miss time in the race for MVP, it only helps Harden's case. So we'll see if, you know, again, we've gone over all of the voting issues and the Houston games and, you know, the 40 points, 30 points, whatever. But I do think that as Kevin Durant continues to mend from this hamstring issue, this is going to be a subplot of that, is James Harden and his contention for MVP. So with that, let's go to a couple of the trade deadline rumors that we have as part of our hardwood headlines. A lot of pieces out there, a lot of reports out there, as certain teams are now throwing their hats in the ring and looking to acquire certain pieces. And there's a couple of teams that have thrown their names out there, really intrigued by, and some big names. But I wanted to start with a team that I think is front and center for a number of reasons. One, they made it to the Eastern Conference Finals a year ago. Two, I think a lot of people really believed that this is a team that was going to compete for an Eastern Conference title this year, but got off to a very disappointing start. Injuries a big part of potentially why they got off to that start, but it's the Boston Celtics. And Sam Amick over at The Athletic wrote a really good piece of trade, just it was a trade piece in general. Celtics were a part of it though, but really expanded on the interest in one, you know, Harrison Barnes. Harrison Barnes, of course, with the Sacramento Kings, is a versatile wing guy who can play off the ball, has of course championship pedigree. I guess he has championship pedigree. You know, I've always wondered that, right? We always say guys who have won championships have a championship pedigree. Do you automatically get championship pedigree because you're on a team that won a title? Now, Barnes was a really big piece, of course, of that championship run for the Boston Celtics. Excuse me, the Golden State Warriors. Freudian slip? Ooh, look at that. But regardless, he's a guy that I guess helps, right? And remember, Boston, $28.5 million trade exception acquired in the sign-and-trade with Charlotte. They got that in the Gordon Hayward deal last offseason. So they could use it to acquire Barnes without chipping out, you know, matching salary at least, right? But how does that help with what is wrong with the team, right? Because I have my issues with Boston. I've made it pretty clear, but let's run through some of these numbers because I think when you look at the issues that plague the Boston Celtics, I just don't know if Harrison Barnes checks all the boxes, right? So he adds depth, very good. Depth has been a massive problem for the Celtics team. Bottom half of the league in bench scoring this year and last year, they were 28th. So this is going to help them, right? Marcus Smart, of course, missing time. He's going to come back tonight against Brooklyn. So his presence, Harrison Barnes, helps immensely in that regard. But look at some of the numbers and the issues that Boston has outside of just depth, right? 12th in offensive efficiency, according to Cleaning the Glass. 113.9 points every 100 possessions in non-garbage time minutes. Awesome. But, again, when you look at what the problem with the Boston Celtics offense, it has been a stagnant offense that sometimes fails to move the ball, and thus it leads to issues like blown leads like they had that one game against the New Orleans Pelicans. It leads to getting blown out by the Atlanta Hawks on the road right before the All-Star break. It leads to a lot of things, a lot of issues. So look at some of these numbers in terms of the Celtics and the fluidity of their offense. They're 28th in assist rate this season. 54.5% of their baskets are assisted on. Really low number. They're 26th in assist-to-turnover ratio, 1.58. But then when you get into some of the deeper numbers, some of the second spectrum numbers that the NBA offers, that's where it really paints a picture of what the problem is for Boston. 22nd in passes made per game, 282.5. And the most damning stat of all, to me at least, Boston Celtics, 29th in secondary assists per game, like the hockey assist, just two secondary assists per game. You know how bad that is? That is no ball movement whatsoever. That is horrendous. And so what I wonder is, when we've watched this Celtics team play, because we're going to get into some of the road issues that they've had, the defensive issues too, a guy like Harrison Barnes, how much does that help you in that regard? How much does Harrison Barnes being on the floor help the ball movement, help the flow of the offense, help you not get bogged down in half-court sets where it's just give it to Jason Tatum, give it to Jaylen Brown, give it to Kemba Walker, set a screen, let him work and get some space. And to give Barnes credit, he's actually a really solid passer. You look at each of the last two seasons. Last year for Sacramento, 9.1 assist rate, 59th percentile at his position. This year, he's actually passed the ball extremely well, 13.4% on the assist rate. So maybe he does help them in that regard, right? And again, he doesn't need to be a point guard. But just a guy like what Gordon Hayward did so well and what he does so well right now with Charlotte is that he makes that extra pass, right? He is a guy who will grab some of those secondary assists because he will see the way that the floor is set up and make a pass that will then lead to another to an open shot. And Harrison Barnes could potentially do that. And so I could be wrong on that. But I just feel like when I look at the problems that Boston has, like my first thought wasn't Harrison Barnes. It checks some boxes. It doesn't check them all. And you know what? Maybe in the trade deadline, you're not going to trade all the boxes. The other name that's been thrown out there for Boston is an old retread for them, Al Horford. And I think Horford would be a relatively solid addition in my mind, right? Floor spacing big that can bring some of the lumbering fives out along the perimeter, forcing him to close out on him if he's open from deep. We're talking about a 36% three-point shooter, right? Again, has to be open, not going to be a knockdown shooter. He's also a solid playmaker for a big, right? We're talking about, again, the secondary assists, this ball movement. He's ranked in the 92nd percentile or higher at his position in each of the last nine seasons in assist rate, as we know. This year, 22.7% of his teammates made baskets he's assisted on. He also provides help defensively, right? Celtics have been shockingly inconsistent on that end of the floor this season. Some of their numbers, 15th in overall defensive efficiency, again, according to Cleaning the Glass, which sorts out the garbage time minutes, 112.6. On the road, it's been atrocious, 20th, 114.4. And look, Marcus Smart has been out, so that could be the reason behind the inconsistencies defensively. But Horford also shores up a relatively thin front court, right? Tristan Thompson hasn't really been what I thought he was going to be. It's not like I thought he was going to be an all-star, but I thought he was going to be a very solid presence in the front court. On the floor, just a wash, 0.0 in terms of the net rating with Tristan Thompson on the floor. Those Tristan Thompson, Daniel Tice lineups, ugh. Like, you can kind of miss me with those. They're not that fluid offensively. Horford gives them another scoring presence on the floor, not just a guy who can operate within 3 feet of the basket like Tristan Thompson has to for the most part. And so I think Horford does, personally, check a few more boxes than a Harrison Barnes does, right? I mean, one of my issues with Boston has been, I make the sarcastic quote all the time, that they're just a team that is loaded with 6'7", 6'8", wings. And here we go, interest in another one in Harrison Barnes. So Celtics, of course, the one that I think are going to interest a lot of people because they are a team that has been relatively disappointing. And the market still, you know, really respects for the most part too, right? If you're looking at the big picture stuff in terms of the futures odds, but even on a night-to-night basis, I mean, I think a lot of people got really excited that they had won four straight going into the second half of the season. But then you look and you realize, well, they only covered two of those games. Again, speaking to the potential overvalued nature of this team. And again, today, we'll see, right? You're going to be able to listen to this potentially once the games are all over. But again, getting numbers or actions today, number against Brooklyn down to 2.5. And yes, Jeff Green potentially won't play, Timothy Luau-Cabarro, but this is a Celtics team that gets support consistently. And then you look at the big picture stuff again as we talk about trade deadline things and what this means. You know, if they acquire Harrison Barnes, if they acquire an Al Horford, it's really not going to change anything from a futures perspective. But you as a bettor can dive into some of the numbers we talked about and make the decision for yourself is if they get Harrison Barnes with everything I just discussed, is getting Boston at 30-1 to win a championship, is that worth it to you, right? Conference-wise, right now Boston 12-1 to win the Eastern Conference. Is that worth it to you if they get a Harrison Barnes or an Al Horford, the two names that they are really focused in on getting, according to some of the rumors? But personally, I just think it's pretty astounding when you look at the pecking order of things. Again, speaking to the respect that the Celtics get at the window, right? Boston Celtics 30-1, Denver Nuggets 30-1, Miami Heat 30-1, Suns at 30-1. So again, the implied probability that the Boston Celtics have the exact same chance of winning this championship as a team like the Phoenix Suns. And yes, conferences matter. Liability matters when it comes to some of these numbers, but it gives you an idea of how much respect there is behind Boston when it comes to the windows. So I don't know if I love the Harrison Barnes thing. I don't hate it, though, right? Totally makes sense. Would I think prefer an addition of Al Horford, but it does seem like more and more the Celtics are going to be going after Harrison Barnes. Brian Scalabrine even said it on their team report. So let's move on to some other teams that are looking to purchase potentially at the trade deadline. And one of those, of course, would be the Philadelphia 76ers. Not a surprise that Daryl Morey leading the way, Will Barton, DeLon Wright, P.J. Tucker, George Hill. Four names that were thrown out there because of a report by Jason Dumas over at Bleacher Report. And you know, I think a couple of them make sense to a certain degree. Some of them don't really in my mind. So we'll start with a guy like Will Barton, right? Will Barton, I think, really makes a lot of sense for a team like Philadelphia. Philadelphia has been average. We'll call it average. On offense, right? They're a team that, for some reason, thrives in the mid-range. I thought they'd be taking a lot more threes than they really are. Bottom 20s in terms of three-point frequency, in terms of the amount of threes, just straight-up attempts per game. According to Cleaning the Glass, 27th in three-point frequency. 30.2% of their attempts come from beyond the arc. And from a shooting perspective, at least percentage-wise, 36.8% on all three-point attempts. This is a team they thought was going to be a little bit better from that regard. And it's not like Barton is a knockdown shooter, right? We're talking about Barton in the range of 36-37% this year. But he's a versatile wing defender. He can shoot. And of course, he can score, which is something I think the 76ers team needs desperately, especially when you look at some of the numbers when we're talking about Joel Embiid on the court and off the court. And it's something I have brought up, you know, quite a bit, right? Joel Embiid off the court, the negative 10.8 net rating, but it goes farther than that, right? The negative 10.8 net rating is there largely because of an offense that only musters 104.8 points every 100 possessions when Embiid is resting, right? That's a really big problem. When you look at some of the shooting numbers, when Joel Embiid comes off of the floor, they manage just 59.2% at the rim, 42% on all mid-range shots. And how about this in terms of three-point shooting? Embiid off the floor, think about that, 31.4% from beyond the arc. A guy like Barton is going to help that immensely, right? And he's also going to add to their defensive profile because they're still a really solid defensive team. So I really like the acquisition of Barton if that is going to be a name that the 76ers roll out there and acquire. George Hill, also a name that I really don't hate. And look, George Hill, as we have seen this year, right, has been, we'll call it, I guess, tentative in terms of his willingness to play for the Oklahoma City Thunder, but we have seen him in the 14 games. From a efficiency standpoint, George Hill, one of the better players in the NBA that you're going to see this year alone. Again, it's only a 14-game sample size, 127.6 points per shot attempt or per 100 shot attempts in his career. If you're looking at the stretch here, three out of the last four seasons, he has finished in the 90th percentile or higher at his position in points per shot attempt. He can create looks. He's also a decent passer. Not the best passer in the world, but he is a decent passer that can get it done. But again, just from a shooting standpoint, again, which is something the Philadelphia 76ers always seem to need, 46% for the Milwaukee Bucks a season ago. He was 46% in his last year in Cleveland, right? And he split that in half, right? He got traded to Milwaukee. But in that year, he was 46%. It was 13-28. Really solid sample size in his last 13 games in Cleveland. But regardless, on 175 shot attempts last year for Milwaukee, was a 46% three-point shooter, but he just adds that presence, right? And I think it's pretty clear that when you look at Philadelphia and what they're looking at, the pieces and the interest have all been in the backcourt, along the wings, right? Adding to that in terms of depth with ball handlers and shot creation. I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think those two names, Will Barton and George Hill, would be names that I'm like, I'm in. Like, that to me makes a slight difference here for Philadelphia in terms of pushing them towards competing in the Eastern Conference. Because again, look at like the big picture here, what we're talking about, right? Yes, the Brooklyn Nets are absolutely spectacular, and you know, you're going to have to be able to exploit them defensively and slow them down somehow on defense. And guys like George Hill, Will Barton will help you along the defensive side while adding some offensive pop, so then you can exploit that. Outside of that though, right? The Milwaukee Bucks, who have their issues, especially along the perimeter, again, 24th or lower in all three categories defensively, in terms of three-point shooting defensively. And then what do you look at after that in terms of the Eastern Conference, in terms of the guys and the teams that are standing in the Philadelphia 76ers way? The Celtics, who we just discussed, who are looking to acquire Harrison Barnes to potentially improve them, right? The Miami Heat, I think, are legitimate Eastern Conference contender because they're starting to get healthy and they're in the trade market. We'll talk about them in a second. And then after that, it really falls off. The Toronto Raptors are a rumored sell team at this point, which actually ties us into one of the names as well that has really been thrown out there for Philadelphia, and that would be, of course, Kyle Lowry. Now, what you have to give up to acquire Kyle Lowry is the massive issue, especially with the contract as well. But again, as we look at some of the reports that are out there, to refer back to Sam Amick's piece in The Athletic, he talked about Kyle Lowry and threw out a package that would include Danny Green, Seth Curry, right? Matisse Thybul, potentially all three. Like, what's the point? So while a guy like Kyle Lowry would be, I think, phenomenal for a team like Philadelphia, there doesn't seem to be much sense in acquiring him if you're going to strip down all the parts just to get him, right? He's not that type of a player. A Kawhi Leonard is, but a Kyle Lowry who would be a great, great piece for the Philadelphia 76ers, for the Los Angeles Clippers, just the action of acquiring him just doesn't make much logical sense for the Philadelphia 76ers. So when you look at some of these names, might not be the sexiest for Philadelphia, who right now, again, we're talking about in the range of about 12-1 to win the NBA Finals, right? And that number courtesy of DraftKings, you can shop around for some of these numbers. But if we're talking about in that range of 12-1, does an acquisition of a Will Barton, depending on what you give up, a George Hill, does that push them toward being an NBA Finals champion? Not sure about a Finals champion, but I think it definitely solidifies their spot as a top two team in the Eastern Conference. And then I think when you start to look at it, those trades really make a lot of sense. The other names are out there, DeLon Wright, then P.J. Tucker. P.J. Tucker didn't really make much sense. Tucker really makes sense as a small ball five. We have seen it multiple times. We saw the experiment last year. I just don't know how he fits in there next to a Joel Embiid and a Ben Simmons, potentially in some of those non-Joel Embiid minutes. P.J. Tucker comes out there. But does that make the difference for you as a team in terms of potentially competing in the Eastern Conference? So a couple of the other teams that we're looking at in terms of potentially selling, or excuse me, buying. I threw out the Miami Heat. Those are definitely one of them. The Heat rumored to be looking at a guy like Nikola Vucevic, which would be pretty interesting. Harrison Barnes has also been thrown in the mix for the Miami Heat as well. And then you look at it too, like what exactly does Miami need? You know, I would think front court depth is probably at the front line of that, right? Kelly Olynyk, from an offensive standpoint, hasn't really been the same. Defensively, he's not the most, we'll call it, solid front court defender. Precious Achiuwa has been absolutely fantastic in some of those minutes as a smallish five that they've been using, too. Hyper-athletic, very good around the rim, and can defend, at least with a lot of energy. But a guy like Harrison Barnes gives them another floor spacer, kind of like a Jay Crowder type. Remember last year, Jay Crowder was absolutely incredible with the floor spacing he provided. Thought he was going to hit every single bleeping shot in the second round against the Milwaukee Bucks. He was also a versatile wing defender. And Harrison Barnes really fits that. And that's why, like, when we were talking about Barnes with the Boston Celtics, I really like a Harrison Barnes type for a team like Miami because I think he fits perfectly with what they would want to do. They're missing Jay Crowder to a certain extent, and Barnes would be perfect in eating up those minutes and filling that role here for that team, being able to make those secondary assist passes, being able to spread the floor and shoot those corner threes when he's open, being able to switch and defend at a versatile rate. Like, that's something that I think Miami would really benefit from having. And so a guy like Harrison Barnes, who the Heat are rumored to be looking at, I think would be absolutely solid piece. And again, too, and I'll beat the drum on this 1,000 times, you can still find the Heat in the range of 15-1 to win the Eastern Conference, 30-1 to win an NBA championship. I bet them at 15-1 myself. This is a team that is getting healthier and better. And again, tonight we're recording this on a Thursday. Nikola Vucevic actually could eat them up because Bam Adebayo is not going to play tonight. But Miami is one of those teams that I think in an Eastern Conference that doesn't have a lot going on in terms of depth, right, that really falls off after Miami because Toronto is rumored to be potentially looking to sell one Kyle Lowry, that a piece like this, like a Harrison Barnes, like a Nikola Vucevic, which by the way, a report today on Thursday said that the Orlando Magic are out on dealing Vucevic to anywhere. We'll see if that's actually the case by the time we get to the trade deadline in 2 weeks. And I don't really know if I love Vucevic to Miami personally anyway. But a piece like a Barnes would totally, I think, improve the Miami Heat's chances of winning the Eastern Conference. And then you get to the two Los Angeles teams as we kind of shift our focus to the West, right? Because a lot of these teams we've talked about in terms of buying at the trade deadline, all Eastern Conference teams. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because the Eastern Conference is really open. But the Western Conference, to a certain extent, is open just because it's really freaking deep. The Los Angeles Lakers clearly aren't happy with the minutes that they're getting from Marc Gasol, and that's why I think they've been rumored to go out and acquire a guy like Andre Drummond. Don't really know what Drummond provides in terms of rim protection and things like that, but if you look at some of the numbers with Marc Gasol this year, like, they're fine, but I think it's more of what he provides and what they had a season ago, right? So according to Cleaning the Glass, Marc Gasol right now on the floor, a plus 4.4. And really, a lot of that stems from the lineup that they use him most with, which is their starting lineup. Dennis Schroeder, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, LeBron James, Anthony Davis, Marc Gasol, that rating plus 13.4. But if you throw Marc Gasol on there and you put him out there really with anybody else, take LeBron James off the floor, for example, that's when you start to see some of the issues. Negative 21.4 in terms of the net rating with LeBron James off the floor and Marc Gasol on the floor. Throw Marc Gasol on the floor with Anthony Davis, and LeBron's still out there in the mix as well. We're talking about a negative 2.8 net rating, right? And everything that plagues the Lakers is not Marc Gasol's fault, but he just hasn't been what they wanted him to be. And so they're in the market for a center. Andre Drummond is the name that has been thrown out there as well. Gives him a little bit more physicality around the rim, at least in terms of offensive presence, right? He's a double-double machine, would help with the rebounding. Remember last year, too, you know, JaVale McGee, Dwight Howard, they were so good because, and they fit so well with the Lakers, just clean up the glass, right? Miss shot, that's fine. We'll go up there, get an offensive board, put it back. You know, Andre Drummond could potentially do stuff like that. He is more suited to do stuff like that than a Marc Gasol, who's a little bit slighter, a little bit leaner, not as physical as some of these guys. And look, I wrote about this in the NBA betting guide about Marc Gasol and about some of the, I guess, negatives around Gasol as a center. It was the fact that from an offensive rebounding standpoint, he's not the same guy as the guys that they lost. And so I think that's why you potentially see the Los Angeles Lakers in the running for some depth in the front court. And then you get the Los Angeles Clippers. My Clippers. A team that I have said 1,000 times over, I think at least, should be in the market to acquire a point guard of any sort. Any sort. And one of the names that is thrown out there that we just spoke about in terms of the Philadelphia 76ers going to look at would be George Hill. And I think George Hill helps to a certain extent with some of the issues we have seen with the Clippers in terms of the stagnant ball movement, in terms of the lack of shots around the rim. He doesn't really help entirely that much in that regard. I think that's the one issue with acquiring a George Hill. I think he'll improve them, at least in terms of the frequency attempts within 4 feet of the basket. But George Hill himself has not really been a guy who thrives within 4 feet. But the last three seasons, he's been a lot better at it. You look at his split year, Cleveland-Milwaukee, right? 13 games in Cleveland, 36% of his attempts came within 4 feet of the basket, 34% of his attempts in the second half of that year with Milwaukee came within 4 feet of the basket. Last year with Milwaukee, 35% of his attempts came within 4 feet of the basket, and 33% of his attempts thus far this year have come within 4 feet of the basket or at the rim. That would help immensely, I think, the Los Angeles Clippers. Because one of the issues that the Clippers have had, and by the way, you saw it, think about this, down the stretch in those last four games, because they looked pretty bad the last four games, the Los Angeles Clippers was pretty uneven. 30 attempts at the rim? Combined! Not even, we're not talking about average, we're talking about combined. Like, that's a really insanely low clip for the Los Angeles Clippers, right? And then you're talking about just like the season-long numbers. As we look at some of the shooting numbers that we have provided to us, again, the Los Angeles Clippers, while they might be one of the best offensive teams in the NBA, and in fact, right now, we'll double-check this, let's see, the non-garbage time numbers that Clean the Glass has to offer. Third in offensive efficiency, 119.1. But part of the issue with this Clippers offense has been the fact that they don't shoot at the rim. Right now, 29th in rim frequency, 26.5% of their attempts come within 4 feet of the basket. To me, that's something that has to change. George Hill helps with that. A point guard really helps with that. And so that's why I think we see the Los Angeles Clippers definitely in the running for a guy like a George Hill. Reggie Jackson lineups are pretty intriguing as well. I think we've seen a couple of the numbers. You know, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, right? Andrew Greif was with us as we discussed the Los Angeles Clippers in a pretty deep divey fashion and what Jackson meant to them, at least from an on-court, off-court standpoint, and what he could potentially provide. But George Hill has been a name that has been thrown out there for the Los Angeles Clippers. But again, Clippers, you know, this was reported just about within the last 12 hours. Lou Williams was probably going to be one of the pieces that is potentially being used in a trade package. Well, he's been playing better. He's maybe ingratiated himself with the franchise a little bit more. And now he might be staying put. So maybe this is the Clippers that we see. Maybe this is the Clippers team that is going to walk into the Western Conference postseason. But I think the hole at point guard has popped up enough times, and they're smart enough to realize that. And I think that maybe we'll see some sort of Band-Aid on the position.
This is the Hardwood Handicappers Podcast. Interact with the show on Twitter at me, JVT, at Roach_97, and at VSIN Live.
All right, with trade deadline stuff out of the way, let's move on. We have a couple of tough schedules. We have easy schedules to go over as we look ahead to the second half. So three schedules that I think we should really keep our eye on as we move forward because of the level of difficulty that some of these teams are going to face. And first and foremost is going to be the San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs have, I think, an incredible schedule when you look at what's in front of them. And again, they played on the opening night, right? Took a loss to Dallas. So they have 39 games remaining. But just, you know, look at this. They had 40 games in the second half, over 67 days to play. 17 of them at home, only 23 of them away. They have the second hardest schedule in terms of just the strength of schedule itself. And on top of that, 11 back-to-backs. San Antonio, for the second half, is due for just a grind. And we use that a lot, but this is going to be insane. And look, road games aren't right what they are or what they used to be, especially in today's day and age where they're all essentially playing on neutral courts. But 11 back-to-backs thrown in there, multiple scheduling spots, the April 22nd being a big one. And it's, you know, it's against Detroit, but the eighth game in 12 days. They have on their schedule set up right now, by my count, four different situations where they'll be playing their fifth game in seven nights. March 20th on the road against Milwaukee, April 17th on the road against Phoenix, that Detroit game we just mentioned, and then May 8th on the road against the Portland Trailblazers. So not only is their second half schedule littered with back-to-backs, majority of these second leg of back-to-backs and fifth game and seven night situations are on the road, right? On the road against Milwaukee, on the road against Phoenix, on the road against Portland. And those are some really quality competition that they have to face in that regard. And so if we're looking at toughest schedules, San Antonio Spurs are up there. And I think they do have the toughest schedule going forward. And we throw that in too, as we look ahead, because at least for myself, you know, San Antonio was a team that I think I had some questions about the legitimacy of how good they had been performing up to this point, right? Especially from a defensive standpoint. San Antonio right now, fifth in defensive efficiency, 110 flat is what they were giving up. And you look at this team from an offensive standpoint, you realize how poor they are. And you saw it in that matchup on Wednesday night against the Dallas Mavericks. The offensive rating in that one, 110.8, really fell off in the fourth quarter in terms of just offense. Overall, relatively poor night from the floor, most of it coming from the mid-range area, 14 to 38. But this is an offense that tends to get a little stagnant, and then that doesn't perform very well. And then when all of a sudden your offense doesn't start performing, or excuse me, your defense, then you have some problems, and I think that's what we're going to start to see here. You know, one of the things I wrote about in the first half when it came to the San Antonio team was the fact that if you looked at some of their numbers in terms of what they give up within 4 feet of the basket, just in terms of frequency, they give up quite a bit, right? Right now, according to Clean of the Glass, in terms of frequency of opponent attempts within 4 feet of the basket, San Antonio is 25th in the league. And yet, somehow, right now, they're fourth in opponent shooting within 4 feet. So they give up the seventh most looks within 4 feet, but they give up the fourth best percentage within 4 feet. And so things like that, that stick out to me from a defensive standpoint. A team that last year was 23rd in defensive efficiency seems to be playing above their head. And now, as we look forward, has a schedule that is the second toughest in the NBA with 40 games over the rest of the way. Again, they played one last night and 11 back-to-backs. San Antonio has been a team that I had circled immediately when we were doing the All-Star break stuff and moving forward and thinking, all right, what are we expecting going into the second half? Immediately, San Antonio comes to mind with the level of schedule that they're going to face. And, you know, since we're on it, talking about teams that have some tough schedules, you know, and teams that played last night on Wednesday, the Memphis Grizzlies have a really, really tough schedule in front of them as well. And theirs is mainly due to, just like the San Antonio Spurs, delays forcing them to postpone games into the second half. They also, before last night, had 40 games left on their schedule, right? 11 back-to-backs as well for the Memphis Grizzlies. April 17th, they play at Milwaukee. It'll be their eighth game in 12 nights. May 11th, they play at home against Dallas. That'll be their eighth game in 12 nights. If you look overall, you're talking about five different situations for the Memphis Grizzlies. March 20th at home against Golden State. April 12th at home against Chicago. April 17th on the road against Milwaukee. May 6th at the Detroit Pistons. And then May 11th at home versus Dallas. All of those are going to be five-game, seven-night type situations as well. From a strength of schedule standpoint, 13th best in the NBA, 13th strongest. So it's going to be a challenge on top of it. The interesting facet, I guess, when it comes to Memphis and what this team is going to be going forward is while the strength of schedule is, you know, again, one of the tougher ones in the league, they're also a team that we know is going to get better, right? Jaren Jackson Jr. is going to come back at some point. Justice Winslow has been back in the mix for a few games as well. And so we know that they have reinforcements coming. We know that they're going to be better. But just given the state of their schedule going forward and the majority of road games, the back-to-back situations, Memphis is going to be a fascinating follow in the second half as they continue, and I think they've won now, what, covered four straight, dating back to the second half, of course. As they continue to perform very well, especially on the defensive end, how they get pushed in the second half is going to be something. Because, look, I wrote about this, this was like 2-3 days ago, released the power rankings for the second half of the NBA season. And one of the things you look at when it comes to Memphis and what you're expecting as you move forward is some of the offenses that they're going to face, or excuse me, some of the defenses that they're going to face, how that works against their offense is going to be pretty incredible, because this is the offense that ranks 21st in efficiency. It's an offense that when the floaters aren't falling, it's absolutely insane how inefficient it can look. But when the floaters are falling, like they were against Washington the other day, they can look like a well-oiled machine. But they're really going to get tested. And I'm really intrigued to watch Memphis because it's a team that I have not had a good read on. I have taken my shot a couple of times in the last few days and fell each time. Actually bet on them with Washington twice. And then, of course, the Milwaukee game right before the break where the Milwaukee Bucks open was a 31-17 lead in the first quarter, but then don't hit a single three-point attempt until the final 40 seconds and ultimately steal one from Memphis. But it's been a team I haven't had a good read on. Now they're 18-14-1 against the spread and been performing very well. But this schedule, I think, is going to answer a lot of questions about Memphis and what they could potentially be. And then this is really quick because I don't know how much lower the power rating can get on this team. But if we're talking about second-half schedules that are brutal, Houston Rockets. What did the Houston Rockets do to the NBA gods, huh? Houston Rockets now have, if you're talking about strength of schedule, the hardest schedule left at this point right now in terms of strength of schedule. And they're a team that, as we know, has been absolutely abhorrent. But it's also not just strength of schedule that is going to screw the Houston Rockets as you get into the second half, right? It's going to be the fact that they're also kind of loaded up with back-to-backs as well. Houston, if you break down their schedule going forward, ...38 remaining games, skew at home, 21-17 away, but they have 10 back-to-backs. They have five different five-game, seven-night situations in the second half. March 27th, they'll be playing their 11th game in 17 nights, and that's going to be on the road against Minnesota. 10 total back-to-backs. So you have the hardest schedule in terms of strength of schedule. You're tied for the second most back-to-backs in the second half. You have, again, five of those five-game, seven-night situations, and you have one on your schedule on March 27th, which is going to be an 11th game in 17 nights against the Minnesota Timberwolves. It's absolutely incredible. So those are three schedules to look out for and three teams that really have it in front of them going forward. So with that, let's wrap it up with some of the easier schedules that we're going to see here heading into the second half. And let's start with a team that is at the top of the Western Conference, at the top of the league right now. Can't get much easier for the Utah Jazz than it is at this point as we head into the second half for Utah, because they were dealt a relatively favorable hand at this point. If you look at Utah and their remaining schedule down the stretch here, littered with opponents that are, we won't call it a cakewalk, but will definitely pave the way for some success. Of the Jazz's 36 games in the second half, 19 come against opponents that rank 15th or lower in net rating, and 15 of those rank 20th or lower according to Cleaning the Glass. You do have a scheduling quirk to look out for. April 8th, the Jazz are going to play Portland for their fifth game in 7 nights. It's also going to be their ninth game in 14 days, second leg of a back-to-back. So if you're looking for something to circle, that is going to be one of the spots. But just think about that, right? A team that is at the top of the league right now not only plays a schedule that is littered with teams that are 15th or lower in net rating, 20th or lower in net rating. Strength of schedule-wise, that leads them to the 30th rated schedule. Of course, easiest left of all the teams. Only 8 back-to-backs. A skew of home games as well. 19 compared to 7. You know, from a cover perspective, you know, we could be seeing some pretty big numbers for Utah as they take on some of these lesser opponents. But this is going to be a second half in which Utah is still going to look like the team that we have seen in the first half. And that power rating is going to continue to climb. And maybe that opens the door for some value playing against them in the Western Conference postseason once that gets started. But those odds are going to continue to shrink as they get to beat up on the easiest schedule that is left in the association. The other that is worth talking about here is the Los Angeles Clippers. And this is what makes the Clippers so intriguing. You know, we talked about earlier in the podcast their potential targets at the trade deadline and what we're looking for from that perspective. You know, I've written many times about the inconsistencies of the Los Angeles Clippers and what they have done. But from a strength of schedule standpoint, 17th in the NBA. They have the fewest road games left on their schedule of any NBA team, just 16 games away from home, 18 left. They actually have some of the fewest games, period, in the second half, 34 games. That's all the Clippers have left to play in the second half, so a relatively spaced-out schedule. Only 7 back-to-backs, tied for second most among teams, with back-to-backs remaining. They have a couple of scheduling quirks, right? Orlando, March 30th at home. They're going to be playing their fifth game in 7 nights. April 14th, they're going to be playing another 5-game, 7-night situation. That'll be at home against Detroit. But nothing crazy and out of this world. And so now we look at this overall, and the Pacific Division, right, has been a really big topic of conversation in terms of betting it and who's going to win it and what you could be looking for from a value standpoint. And my trepidation with something like that is looking at what the Clippers have in front of them. I always do that. I don't know why. I have the Lakers right in front of me in my notes. That's potentially why, but regardless, I digress. Looking at what the Clippers have in front of them and then realizing that the Phoenix Suns, for example, the team that a lot of people are looking at to potentially win this division, I think really you're looking at this and wondering, like, you know what? Like, I think this gives you a little pause with Portland or Phoenix, right? Because Phoenix has the 11th hardest schedule left. They have 37 games remaining. 19 of them are going to be on the road. 9 back-to-backs. They have 2 different, 5-game, 7-night situations as well. They're going to be tested in the second half. And I think that's what gives me a little pause. It's Phoenix's schedule, what I potentially think of them, and what the Clippers have in front of them as one of the easiest schedules left in the NBA. And then finally, last one to discuss, at least in terms of strength of schedule and some of the easier ones that are going to be out there, look out for the Miami Heat as they continue to climb their way up here. Miami Heat have the 27th rated schedule going forward in terms of strength of schedule. 36 games on the lower end in terms of games left. 18 and 18 even split. 9 back-to-backs. In terms of 5-game, 7-night situations, they only have 3 of them. And they have 1 negative scheduling spot, right? 8th game in 12 nights on April 24th. That's at home against Chicago. But again, when you're talking about the strength of the opponent that they will be taking on going forward, the Miami Heat are definitely going to be a team. And we, by the way, it's Thursday again. They're taking on Orlando today. That's going to be something to watch too, because they're laying 9 tonight, even without Bam Adebayo. Their power rating is starting to climb. But with these wins, not necessarily covers, but with these wins as they continue to improve their record, 7-1 in their last 8 as of this taping, you're definitely going to see the Miami Heat from a power rating perspective, from a futures perspective, really start to take have their odds start to shrink. So if you're looking at Miami, I've discussed a couple of times here on this podcast, now is the time to do it, because this schedule, again, I don't know if this means that they're going to be good, but this schedule sets up for them to pad that record, to find them way into the top 3, top 4 of the Eastern Conference in terms of seeding, and have their odds start to shrink, because they're going to start to string some wins together, much like they have already over their last 8 games. All right, with that, we are all done. Want to appreciate it. Flying solo here this week. Jacob Roach is going to be back next week. As we, again, start to get really ramped up and over the last 2 months of the schedule. It's already here. So if you want to, please like, rate, review, subscribe. You can send in any questions, complaints at me, JVT, up on Twitter. But we'll be back next week with another edition of the Hardwood Handicappers Podcast. Thank you.